Welcome to the Best of Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This 4th of July, in addition to Americans celebrating our 236th anniversary of independence, historians, history buffs, and Civil War reenactors will continue to observe the sesquicentennial of that conflict as well. In fact, today at Gettysburg, there'll be one of the largest reenactments of Pickett's Charge, even though the official 150th anniversary of this event, known as the high water mark of the Confederacy, is still a year away. Obviously, the memory of this horrific and tragic conflict is still important to many Americans. How we remember this has been the work of Civil War historian David Blight, a professor of American history and the director of the Gilder Lehman School for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. Professor Blight was the keynote speaker at a symposium at Gilcrease earlier this year titled Material Memory. He spoke on the memory boom in public history at the Civil War sesquicentennial. And he tells us today how Americans have remembered, romanticized, reenacted, reflected on, and reacted to the Civil War in the past 150 years. Professor Blight, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
As we remember the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, I would be interested to see if we have remembrances of this conflict today that would be, I don't want to say completely alien, but somewhat alien to citizens of 1860 and 61 or 1865 to 67, immediately after the war. Do we have remembrances that would seem strange to the citizens of that time?
Gosh, that's a very interesting way of asking that question, and I must say I admire the question. I'm so often asked about Civil War memory, but never quite so insightfully. Yeah, I think the answer is yes, there would today, but yes and no. There are many elements of Civil War memory in the popular culture and the popular mind now that wouldn't be terribly different from, let's say, the immediate aftermath of the war. But what would be very different to many people, whatever side they were on, would be probably our realization over the last half century of scholarship and teaching and so forth, of just how deeply significant the question of slavery was at the root of the war, and how important emancipation became over time. Now, you know, in 1865 or 1870, though they were experiencing Reconstruction and all of its vexing and extremely difficult problems, and they were experiencing this reinvention of an American republic through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Those amendments, of course, were deeply, deeply contested. They could not have imagined just how important, over time, the emancipation of 4 million slaves would be to the rewriting of the U.S. Constitution, the transformation of race relations, the ultimate, I mean, it took another century, of course, but the ultimate creation of a civil rights legal regime that we live under now, that they could not have anticipated. No one can anticipate, you know, the ultimate legacies of an event 100 years out when they're experiencing it. In reverse, what I think, I mean, it's very interesting to ask what we don't understand that they did. And I like both sides of this question. Because today, though we have been confronted with the death and sacrifice and the sheer scale of loss in that war in documentary films and in many fine books, still, I think, many, many Americans who are very much interested in this story do not like to look at or do not really even understand the scale of death and loss and destruction that that war brought. We are beginning to understand that much more than we ever have before. Recent books like Drew Faust's book called Republic of Suffering, The Death Culture in the War, my own book and other people who now have written about the long-term memory of the Civil War have begun to really stress this. There are wonderful books out now on the impact of the war and the surviving veterans, which, you know, we like to think about Civil War veterans in a form of nostalgia, a kind of misty view of them, but many, many, many of them suffered through the rest of their lives through something we've come to call post-traumatic stress, but they didn't have any names for such things in the 19th century. This was the pre-psychological era. So there's a lot about that war's sheer brutality and destructiveness. And I'm not sure the average Civil War enthusiast, even today, really wants to confront, although we are trying to get them to.
Yeah, you know, as you probably well know, during the sesquicentennial, we're seeing all sorts of reenactments. And, of course, that's sort of a very popular pastime. And I was thinking about that as I was approaching this interview, and I was thinking nobody in their right mind would try to do a reenactment of World War One.
No. Reenactments of the Battle of the Somme.
Yeah, the sheer carnage. But, you know, there were many times in the Civil War when the carnage of the average Civil War battle between Eastern theater was just as horrific.
And even at Shiloh, you know, the first huge battle with massive casualties that was such a wake-up call to both sides, to the whole country. You know, you're quite right. I mean, the first reenactors, in a way, were the original veterans by the late 19th century, when they started having their blue-gray reunions. And although they never quite did reenacting like it is done today, they were asked to at times, as at the famous 50th anniversary blue-gray reunion at Gettysburg. Groups from both sides, veterans of the actual site of Pickett's Charge, were asked to kind of modestly reenact that, I think a dozen or so on each side. But today, the reenacting phenomenon really began back in the 1950s and then into the 60s around the centennial period of the war, which is what my newest book is about. Mm-hmm. And it had a good deal to do with a kind of nostalgia for a good war in another century, a war that could be imagined as a great adventure, you know, a great outing.
And it's interesting, both North and South could see it as a good war, too.
Oh, indeed. This is part of our problem. We've rendered, and always will be, probably, we've rendered the Civil War into a story of unity, almost because we had to, out of course, terrible disunity. But reenacting is also a kind of, it's kind of a social community phenomenon. For a lot of people who do it, it's a search for community. It's a kind of a club. It's a kind of a secular church, if you want. It's people who gather on weekends and do what they're interested in. There are many, many complicated reasons people do reenacting, and I, for one, am not out to criticize or condemn any of them. They come in many shades and stripes and types of people. All kinds of professions do it, and it's an old, old impulse, you know, in Western civilization, at least, to find places in the past, find events, experiences, episodes in the past that we can retreat to, that we can revel in, that we can go recreate, at least as an escape from whatever it is in the present that we don't particularly want to live with. On the other hand, it does have its odd edges, yes. The idea of reenacting battle. It is a physical rush, no doubt, for many of them who do it. But I'll give you this one little, there was a beautiful, powerful insight in a piece that the great William James wrote, America's greatest philosopher. Right before he died, he wrote a piece called The Moral Equivalent of War in 1910. And he opens it by saying, today, he says, you know, and there, you know, you're almost 50 years out from the Civil War, he says, you could hardly find anyone today who would want to take our great Union War out of our past. He calls it the Union War. Mm-hmm. He says, well, you know, we revel in having that experience. It's great episodes, and it's, you know, it's great leaders and so on. We would never want to take that out of our past. In a sense, he's saying we love that story. And yet, then he says, but you also would probably find no one who would actually want to relive it.
Right, right.
You know, so he's capturing there, in much more eloquent ways than I just described it, this idea that we sometimes allow ourselves this beguiling kind of nostalgia for a past we don't really want to relive if we actually look at its reality. But we do want to touch it. We want to get near it. We want to feel its emotion. We want to feel its rush. We want to feel its authenticity, because so much about modern life, whether it was in 1910 to James or today, alienates us from what feels real. You know, you think about the reenactor who can shut off his iPhone and shut off his email and shut off his telephone, and although I bet a lot of them have their cell phones out in their tent now. But, you know, everyone's looking now for some kind of, well, I don't know if everyone is, but many people are looking for some escape from this technologically obsessed world we have. Well, reenactors have one answer for that. Go live in another century for a day.
Exactly.
And let some people shoot blanks at you. That'll get your attention.
So this is one way we're keeping memory alive of this conflict, and of course your work is focused on how we remember this great conflict. My guest today is David Blight, a professor of American history at Yale University. He won the Bancroft Prize for his seminal book, Race and Reunion, The Civil War and American Memory. His most recent book is American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era, which looks at how we remember the Civil War 100 years later. And, of course, this was a time when I was barely nascent. I'll put this way. I don't remember. But you know what? When I got interested in the Civil War, I was looking back to the world book of that era. And, of course,
really?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting how much
that would be interesting, yeah.
How much has changed in 50 years. Because mm-hmm. back in the early 60s, this you mentioned the Union War that Henry mm-hmm. James referred to. Then it was the Civil War or the war between the states.
Oh,
now,
yeah,
that is
yeah.
that has almost disappeared from our discourse.
Well, it depends on where you ask.
I suppose.
Parts of the South when it is still indeed called that, or there are other kinds of euphemisms as well.
So
you're right. That'd be interesting to look at the World Book Encyclopedia or any other kind around 1960 and see what the war is being called. At the 100th anniversary season of the Civil War, from the late 50s into the mid-60s, it's easy to forget, but that is an era when very, very few Americans knew anything about black history, knew anything about slavery, knew anything about the fact that there were nearly 200,000 black soldiers in the Civil War. This whole story of race and slavery and emancipation at the middle of that conflict was something not just new to people, it was hardly taught, hardly known 50 years ago. It was beginning to be known. There certainly was a scholarship developing, coming out of universities and publishing. But the overall mainstream American narrative and story, which millions globbed onto during the centennial era, was a great struggle of the blue and the gray, with glory enough to go around, an inevitable, difficult, even tragic conflict, but a necessary conflict that in the end was good for all, good for the nation. Out of it came greater unity, out of it came a great world power, etc., etc. So much of what got lost in that big grand narrative, of course, was what deep down the war was really all about. And there are lots and lots of reasons for that. Here we are now 150 years after the event, and it still has this massive audience. It still has this beguiling draw to its nostalgia. It's still the subject of documentary films. Many of them are coming out, in fact, again, even this year. It is still the object of, it's one of the major objects of American historical tourism. It's still the story, one of the stories that most interest people from abroad about us. And there are good reasons for that. It is the great pivot. If you take the long view, it's the great pivot of American history. 80-some years into the story of the American Republic, it destroyed itself.
Mm-hmm.
It tore itself to pieces. And it tore itself to pieces over the issue of slavery, and it had to put itself back together again. That's a heck of a story. It's a terrible story, but it's a heck of a story. And it will probably always draw us, every generation seems drawn to it, but for different reasons, often than the previous generation. All we can hope is that we keep trying to educate the next generations to have a deep deeper and broader view of it.
Well, you mentioned going back 50 years, your book, American Oracle, what's happening in the 1960s in current events is you're literally challenging this view that has emerged 100 years after the war, that it was about states' rights. It was about forging of a nation. What's lost is African Americans and their struggle and the fact that, you know, you basically traded slavery for an apartheid system in the South and with the acquiescence of the whole country. Yes. And yet here at this momentous time of 100 years after the war, this is being challenged on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and in Selma and lunch counters in North Carolina and everywhere. Yeah.
Well, it's easy for people to forget. Whatever people are learning now, and kids certainly grow up learning about the Civil Rights Movement, but the Civil Rights Movement occurred at the very time the country was having a vast official commemoration of the Civil War. There was a big national commission to commemorate the Civil War centennial. It was founded as early as 1957. It was at times a complete debacle because it just could not deal with questions of race. It just couldn't deal with questions of slavery. Even when it was put by President Kennedy under new and better, more progressive leadership of Allen Nevins and Bud Robertson in 1961, they still had a devil of a time getting Southern state commissions, which wanted nothing whatsoever to do with even mentioning questions of slavery and emancipation. They just couldn't get these Southern commissions to even face it. What the Southern commissions and the Southern states and the ex-Confederate community wanted out of the centennial was equality. They wanted a story that was equally about their valor, their survival, and their contribution to the greater nation. In other words, they wanted the Lost Cause tradition validated. And by and large, they got it validated by the National Commission. But as you just mentioned, there are any number of great examples of challenges to that. And the most famous of all, although people don't really understand it, was King's I Have a Dream speech. I mean, if you were to ask Americans of three speeches that they may know about, I mean, Gettysburg Address, King's I Have a Dream speech, and I don't know, maybe they know George Washington's farewell address, I doubt it, but maybe Kennedy's inaugural or something. But the I Have a Dream speech, every kid in the country probably grows up hearing about it, hearing it on a tape, watching a piece of it. But the only part people really ever watch or hear is the last 3 minutes of a 17-minute speech. It's the dream metaphor that King plows into that speech unforgettably in the last 3 minutes that we always remember. The first 14 minutes of that speech is all about the Civil War centennial and the absence of the country's attention to the story of emancipation and to the fact, as King says over and over as a refrain in the speech, "And the Negro is not free." You know, which is his way of saying, because we are still segregated. That speech is the greatest Civil War centennial speech that was given in that period, but that isn't the way it's remembered. We much prefer that kind of unifying dream metaphor than we do to the first 14 minutes where he's chastising the country for its amnesia, its unwillingness to face the real causes and consequences of the Civil War.
And of course, in your writings, that amnesia was intentional. It was the price to be paid for unifying the country after Reconstruction.
Yes, these kinds of using the psychological term amnesia, or let's just call it forgetting, or let's just call it the forging of certain memories over others, are intentional. That doesn't mean we always know it when we're learning it. You know, if you grow up learning the story of something in the past from your parents or your grandparents or your teachers or your church or wherever young people gather a sense of the past, at first they're not aware necessarily that what they're being given is an intentional narrative, an intentional story. Some people may never be fully aware that what they're being taught is intentional, but it is. Some stories win out in the public memory over others, and there are reasons for that. That's why we are studying, lots of us now, memory is ultimately always about the present. You know, it's about how the present forges stories of the past, and therefore there's always a politics to that memory.
You know, when you think of the American Revolution, I think most people, if you said, give me the quick snapshot of the American Revolution, I think probably 80-90% would think of Emanuel Leutze's painting of Washington crossing the Delaware.
Absolutely. There you
that
go.
That is the American Revolution painting. In a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, an event we don't have any photographs of, we rely on these few paintings we have, or the glorious paintings of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
The Philadelphia paintings by Trumbull. In fact, those paintings are two blocks up the street from me here in New Haven, the Yale Art Gallery. But you're right. And in fact, the American Revolution, it's interesting you brought that up, Rich, because in our national memory, if we think about this in the broadest terms, the national public memory, the American Revolution really isn't controversial. You know, it was, of course it was a good war. We fought the British to get rid of monarchy, to found and create the nation. You know, there's a way in which the American Revolution in public memory is just not a problem. I mean, of course, historically, that leaves a lot out. I mean, the American Revolution was actually a civil war on the ground, especially in the southern states and colonies.
We forget that we drug about half the population along into the Revolution.
Exactly, and we forget that probably a third of them were loyalists, and half of those went into exile after the war. I mean, it was a deeply divisive, brutal kind of civil war, especially in the southern part of the country then. But in its aftermath, of course, it becomes our founding, and therefore a narrative and a story evolves from that in public memory that tells us, well, it was inevitable. You know, there had to be an American Republic, and so. But it, you know, you go back; you don't have to look too closely to know there's nothing inevitable about the Americans winning that war. There was every reason to think they wouldn't win it. There's nothing inevitable about the U.S. Constitution actually being forged and created by 1787. There's nothing inevitable about that fledgling little republic even surviving the 1790s and into the early 19th century, and so on and so on. And when Lincoln stands there at Gettysburg and says, 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth in this continent a new nation, conceived da 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 da, that's Lincoln saying, you know, 80-some years ago, this republic was founded, and it was conceived on these principles, and man, this was an extremely difficult thing for them to forge and create. And then he says, my fellow Americans, that first republic is being destroyed. That's really what he says at the Gettysburg Address, if people go look at it. He's saying, in these graves in front of me here, that first republic is being buried, and our job is to create a new one. Yeah. And he uses, you know, the famous rebirth metaphor.
Right.
It must be a rebirth of freedom. And what he's really saying is that he doesn't know where it's going yet. He's not really predicting. He doesn't know what equality is going to mean. But he's saying that first republic created in the late 18th century, glorious as it is, has just been torn asunder. And our job's to make a new one. That's why the Civil War is the kind of birth of a modern America, a transformation of the American Republic. It really is, as so many scholars now call it, a second American Revolution.
Mm.
The Republic as founded did not work, failed, had to be recreated. And its greatest failure, of course, was this problem of slavery. What to do with the future with racial slavery in it. And it's, I think, why we are drawn back to the Civil War. At whatever level people comprehend this complexity, we do somehow know that, man, that big, terrible Civil War, it destroyed something and it created something, and maybe we ought to know something about it.
You know, when we talk about it, it's the more perfect union, it really is. And we've been working on that more perfect union ever since.
Oh, indeed, yeah. That's a heck of a standard, isn't it?
Yes.
Any country that sets itself up with that as its creed, boy, that's a tough call. You know, And well, that's even in the Declaration, I mean, if you're serious about the Declaration of Independence, those four first principles that Jefferson laid down are creeds. That's what they are. They're the national creeds. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the doctrine of sovereignty, the doctrine of equality, and the right of revolution. You create a republic based on those principles, and then you say you're going to live up to them. You've begun with a contradiction.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, and then you go forward from that. We are a people born in glorious ideas from the Enlightenment, but ideas we were instantly contradicting in the moment we declared them. It's actually what makes us interesting. but we like to smooth that all over, of course.
We do.
We don't like to call ourselves, you know, the people of contradiction. We like to think of our story as a linear story, a story that's always getting better. We're always improving. As somebody once said, the United States was born perfect and then launched on a career of just getting better.
My guest today is David Blight, professor of American history at Yale University. His most recent book, American Oracle, The Civil War in the Civil Rights Era, his best-known book, Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, which won the Bancroft Prize. Our last minute or so, I know you're working on a biography of Frederick Douglass. Is this going to be coming out during the sort of Civil War sesquicentennial?
Well, I sure hope so. But like any author, you know, that's always hope. Yes, I hope to have it out by 2014. I'm about 4 or 5 chapters deep into it now, and I am writing a new complete life of this most important African-American of the 19th century, Frederick Douglass. I'm doing it in part because I was lucky enough to bump into a privately held collection of Douglass material, but I really am... I'm trying to write a full biography that captures not only his historical significance, but even his literary significance. Mm. Douglass's great weapon was his voice, oratorical voice, and his written voice. And I may even call the book a biography of a voice. Douglass, a little bit like Lincoln, is principally remembered for his words and what he wrote. And I'm going to try to tell his life in part through those words.
David Blight, thanks very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Rich.
David Blight speaking with us back in May. He was a keynote speaker at the Material Memory Conference at Gilcrease. He's a professor of American history and the director of the Center for Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. Well, that's the best of Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Have a great and safe 4th of July holiday. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The Price Tower Arts Center in Bartlesville continues its First Friday series of live music events with a performance by Traditional Blend on Friday, July 6th at 8 p.m. at the Price Tower Arts Center. Traditional Blend performs a wide variety of music genres, including but not limited to music from Scotland, Ireland, England, Chicago, New York, Nova Scotia, and North Carolina. For more information on this performance, which is free and open to the public, pricetower.org.